I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Grant Lawrence joins me again, the author, columnist, and broadcaster, has just published his third book. It's a terrific memoir called Dirty Windshields, The Best and Worst of the Smuggler's Tour Diaries. It's a book that looks at the 16 years he toured around the world as the lead singer of the rock and roll band The Smugglers. The book provides terrific insight on the music scene in the 1990s and the legendary venues they played, as well as their travels throughout the world. They gained international popularity, and it's just a delight to read about these young guys getting together, doing art, and reading about their exploits. It's not all great either. There are fights, too much booze, drugs, sexual misadventures, and death. The Smugglers are getting back together this Saturday night, the 13th of May, at the Timeless Commodore Ballroom. Grant will read from his book. There'll be music from other guests, and the band will perform. Visit Ticketmaster for tickets and, of course, Grant's own site at grantlawrence.ca. Grant Lawrence was on this program for his first book in 2010, Adventures in Solitude. Since then, he's published another memoir, The Lonely End of the Rink, and he's had two kids. He appears regularly on CBC Radio and hosts their CBC Radio 3 podcast. You can read Grant's award-winning column in the West Ender Weekly. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Grant Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence, good morning.
Hello, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I was telling you just before we started how much I enjoyed the book, even though this isn't stuff that I would, whether it's the Smugglers or the people that you like listening to it growing up. It's not the kind of music that I'd have on my iPod, but what I enjoyed the most was that your guys who decided to, that you wanted to do this, to get up and perform, make music, make art, and you did it. I mean, there's a great lesson here for the young, isn't there? Not only the young, but anyone who wants to make art, for that matter.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, it's just, we came from a very strict, strict, you know, with a small s, DIY ethic or a philosophy of do it yourself, and because nobody's going to do it for you. And so we thought, well, you know, we saw a really cool band that inspired us on stage, so we thought we could do that too. And of course, in the early years, we were terrible. I mean, we were a really terrible band in the first few years, but, you know, we got better and better and better, and we caught enough breaks that people let us play here, let us play there, let us open for this band or that band, and we slowly got better and better until we actually gained fans. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the lesson is anybody can do it. And also really the overall, I think, message of the book, because the book contains a lot of wanderlust, you know, a lot of, I was always fascinated around what's around the next bend, what's across the next border, what's over that mountain range. And so I think it's for anyone who's you know, dreamers, travelers, and dreamers.
So when you go back, because you just mentioned that you the first 3 years were terrible. When you go back now and listen to it, is it still terrible sounding?
I don't know. Maybe no, it's not. You know, our first album was called At Marineland, and it came out in the fall of '91, I believe. And you know, it's not terrible. There's some good songs on it. I mean, there's songs that will still play today. There's some actually really good recordings on there. There's, you know, I'd say about half of it is passable and about half of it is cringeworthy. You know, I mean, we did some cover of a song called Jailbait, and we just did it because we were kids and we didn't know what it meant or what the term meant. We just thought it was this cool garage rock song that we discovered on some old compilation album. And, you know, now I listen back to it and go like, oh my goodness, like this is, you know, it's totally inappropriate. Yeah. The only irony being that we were kids. So, like, it doesn't even make sense singing about Jailbait. But anyway, so there was those types of cringy, like kids not even knowing what you're singing about. But yeah, you know, for the most part, listening back, it's not so bad.
Yeah, and you guys were young, so I mean, you're expected to make mistakes like that, right?
Yeah, you know, we formed the Smugglers when we were 16 years old, and 16, 17 were the various members. We drafted this bassist who was a lot older than us, who's still in our band, Bees, and he's still a lot older than us. generally 10 years older than us. So yeah, it was, you know, Bees was kind of always tried to, you know, tried to knock sense into us, and we would just kind of ignore him and say, oh, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And he was usually right. You know, one of the opening stories in the book is, well, first of all, before I mention that story, I should say that the smuggler's motto for years was ambition, good times, and denial. So the ambition to just go out and do it, the good times that we would have when we just went out and did it, and then the denial if nobody showed up. You know, oh, yeah. It wasn't that bad. Yeah. You know, maybe it'll be better next time. So the first trip we ever did was over the Rocky Mountains in March. And as you know, most marches in Vancouver, pretty nice, daffodils, cherry blossoms, pretty temperate weather. So we as kids growing up on the West Coast just thought that is what it is like right across Canada in March. And our bassist, Bees, is like, no, he was from the East. He's like, it's winter everywhere else except here. It is winter. And we were like, oh, shut up. Yeah. And, you know, just get in the van. And so, you know, by the time we hit Hope, it was already snowing. And we were totally, totally ill-prepared. The van had no heat, no snow tires. We didn't have proper clothing whatsoever. We had no business trying to cross the Coquihalla or any of that. We went all the way to Regina, mm-hmm. which was terrible planning as well. It's like, oh, yeah, let's go to Regina for the weekend. No one in Vancouver ever says that. But we did, and we did it, and we survived. But, man, was it dumb. Yeah.
Who's John Ruskin?
Well, John Ruskin is the real name of Nardwar, the human serviette. Mm. He doesn't like his real name being used very much, so if he was being interviewed by you right now, he'd probably ignore the question or just say, I am Nardwar, the human serviette. But that's who I grew up with in elementary school and high school, and around grade 12, Nardwar morphed. You know, he went through this change because, you know, we were into punk rock and alternative music, and we saw that a lot of musicians used pseudonyms. So, you know, there was Lux Interior with the Cramps and Johnny Rotten with the Sex Pistols and Joey Shithead with DOA here in Vancouver. And so Nardwar thought, well, that's just what you do. You come up with a pseudonym.
Yeah.
So he came up with the bizarre Nardwar the Human Serviette. And he's had it ever since, and he definitely owns it. And most people, you know, the majority of people only know him as Nardwar. I mean, anyone who knows him as John, you know, that's going back 30 years, really.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I never took the pseudonym route. I never wanted a pseudonym because I've always done a lot of writing, and I always believe that it's easy to hide behind a pseudonym,
right.
and I believe that if you're writing or if you're putting something out there into the world, you should stand by that.
Yeah, and so Nardwar has such a profound part in your life, but also in the genesis of the smugglers, right?
Yes, he was our mentor for sure. There's no question about it. You know, other rock history is that, you know, a lot of bands had mentors, you know, and often guided them. And, you know, on a famous level, you know, Brian Epstein with the Beatles, Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis, and Malcolm McLaren with the Sex Pistols, to name a few.
Uh-huh.
And some bands had fake mentors. You know, the Gruesomes had some guy named Fuad Ramses, which I thought was a real guy for years, and it turns out it was just the lead singer under yet another pseudonym. But Nardwar was real, and he was really, really good to us. So he was 3 years older than us, and he, you know, urged us to form a band. He urged us to play gigs. He would book us on his all-ages shows, both on the North Shore where we grew up and downtown. He would introduce us to cool touring bands. from exotic places like Montreal and Los Angeles. And he formed a record label pretty much right out of high school called, of course, Nardwuar Records. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, I mean, he was incredible in all of that, again, that do-it-yourself spirit. And that's where we learned it all from. And then eventually, Nardwuar's all-ages gigs in particular started getting a little bit popular, and so I helped out in the organization of that. My phone number was on a lot of the posters in the early days, and my house, which was, you know, I mean, it was a large suburban house. Mm-hmm. It became the de facto kind of hotel for a lot of the touring bands that would come through playing Nardwuar shows. So yeah, Nardwuar and I don't work with Nardwuar as much anymore because he does his video thing and does his interviews, but we're still very good friends, and we have been friends since I was in about grade 9. He kind of rescued me I was really bullied, which I talk about in my second book, and, mm-hmm. and I really credit Nardwuar for kind of pulling me out of that and setting me on a path of rock and roll.
There's a beautiful story at the beginning of the book. Near the beginning of the book, where I guess you, the two of you, go to a show downtown here in Vancouver.
That's right.
And
yeah.
I can't remember the name of the band now, but and you have that moment that you know artists have, where you're mesmerized or you're fascinated by what you're seeing, and you think to yourself, I could do that.
Yeah, and that's a real, you know, call it whatever you want, that the trigger moment, the light bulb moment, but I believe that all artists have that moment, and no matter what your medium, and somewhere along the line you are inspired. All artists are inspired, whether it's reading a great book or seeing a spectacular painting or a dancer or whatever. And so for me, it was at a club that's long gone in our ever shifting downtown of Vancouver. I was Club Soda, which for years was at the corner of Homer and Nelson. Mm-hmm. And it became the Starfish Room, which the Smugglers ended up playing many, many, many times. But that night, Nardwuar and I snuck into Club Soda, and it was to see the Gruesomes from Montreal. And I had seen a few concerts. I saw ZZ Top at the Pacific Coliseum. And in the Expo year, I was really into old rock and roll. So the Expo year, they had a series of kind of classic rock and roll shows. So I saw Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis and Freddie Cannon and mm-hmm. the Beach Boys. But, you know, all these guys, they were like in their middle age by then. And it just wasn't that visceral. It wasn't that exciting. It wasn't dangerous. And sneaking into Club Soda was all of those things because we weren't supposed to be there. So it was forbidden in that way. The club was painted black. It wasn't some bright amphitheater. The people in the club all looked dangerous, leather jackets and spiked hair and, postures like question marks and smoking. That was when we could smoke inside and drinking. Yeah. And so all of this was just kind of a sensory overload for me. And then when the band got on stage, I could... You know, I wasn't stuck in, like, row 138 in the nosebleeds. If I wanted to, could squirm my way right up to the lip of the stage and be right under the lead singer. And that was just unbelievable. The volume, the power, the energy of it all just completely swept me away. And I left that club back into the rainy streets, and I just thought, that is what I want to do. And I went back to high school the next morning, all exhausted, but very, very inspired, and said to my friends, we already had a band, but it was kind of an R&B band based on kind of the early Rolling Stones. And I called the One-Eyed Jacks, and I went back and I said to the guys, I know what we have to do now. I know how we have to play. I know what we're going to do. We're going to tour and we're going to put out records, and we're going to, you know, at that point I just thought, oh, we're going to tour Canada.
Yeah.
But then the Smugglers ended up touring much, much further than that.
So you had no idea when this all started, what the Smugglers would become.
No, of course not. But, you know, I had a lot of ambition, and I think that a lot of people, I mean, I did not fulfill our ambition. I mean, my ambition was to be like, you know, as big as the Rolling Stones or, mm-hmm. you know, to be a big band. Now, we, after a while, I realized that the music, that my dad was right, that the music business is a black hole. And after a while, I realized to be thankful for what we had. So the Smugglers reached a level of popularity that was just like what I experienced with mm-hmm. the Gruesomes at Club Soda. We could sell out 300-person clubs all around the world. We could sell them out in Peterborough, in Paris, in Tokyo, and Tuscaloosa, and both Londons.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great, you know. And so I realized that, you know, playing to clubs filled with 300 people, that was our comfort zone. And I thought, well, this is really cool. Now, the one thing that the Smugglers never had is we were a hitless wonder. We never had a hit song. And really, to sustain a career long-term in the music industry, you really do need that kind of permeating hit where when someone hears it, you know, your pal Frank Sinatra, you know, that's what he often said. Like, if you have one hit, you've made it, and you're very, very lucky to have that one hit. And never forsake that hit. You know, always be happy to play it because you're very, very lucky to have it. And the Smugglers got close a couple of times
mm-hmm.
With a couple of songs, but we never quite had that kind of breakthrough song that takes you back to a certain summer or a certain place. Now, some of our fans would argue, but those are our, you know, our cult-like fans. It never permeated mainstream.
So you mentioned all this great stuff. You know, you guys are able to create your art, and you're able to do it around the world as you do. But there are dark parts to it. I mean, unpleasant parts. I mean, we know certain members of the band are no longer with us.
Yeah.
They've died.
Yeah.
There is that side of it. And when you take all the bad stuff, the drugs, the booze, and even just the being tired from the touring, I mean, mm-hmm. that contributes to the band sort of disbanding, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's definite burnout factor. I mean, it's an adventure, right? I mean, you know, there's a reason that, like, explorers, you know, don't do it. They, you know, there's a reason why explorers are often young. If you look through history, you know, your Alexander Mackenzies and your Captain Vancouver's, and you know they're young men, and in their older age they just wanted to kind of kick back and stay home if they survived their travels, you know. And so we were adventurers with guitars, and we wanted to set out and see the world and explore and do our thing, and it's a young person's game to a certain degree. Now I know that there's a lot of musicians that do it well into their middle ages and mm-hmm. beyond, but those are often the musicians that do have the hits and can sustain a career and play in, you know, much more comfortable venues. My wife, who's in her 30s, who's much more in line with your likes, Ella Fitzgerald and Sinatra, you know, she's able to tour to soft seat theaters. There's only so far you can go with, you know, clubs that, you know, smell like urinal pucks and are painted black. But, you know, and you're right, there's hazards of the road. I mean, we're very, very thankful that there wasn't any major accidents. You know, there's a couple of fender benders here and there, but, you know, there's horrible stories of bands, you know, members falling asleep at the wheel and careening off the road and, you know, people getting killed. But, you know, there are other hazards, which you mentioned, which is the drugs and alcohol, and I say this in the book, and I maintain that rock and roll is pretty much the only gig in the world where, I mean, you name me another job where you can show up at your place of work and slam your hand down and demand that there's 36 or 48 beer on ice waiting for you upon arrival at your place of work. Not to mention that your time of arrival could be anywhere from 3 to 6 p.m. and you don't play till 11 p.m. or midnight.
Yeah.
And so you're not only encouraged, you're not only allowed to do your job drunk or wasted or stoned or whatever, you're actually encouraged to do it. And if you play seven nights a week or even six nights a week and that alcohol is available to you every single night, I mean, in any other line of work, you would be considered like a raging alcoholic.
Yeah.
But in rock and roll, oh, no, you're considered, you know, a survivor, or you're considered Keith Richards, or you're considered a party animal. So that slippery slope, not only do we have members that deal with that slippery slope every day as an echo to it all,
yeah.
But we have members that just, as you mentioned, did not make it, that died from one from a heroin overdose and one from complications due to alcoholism.
Yeah. So when you play the Commodore this Saturday,
yeah.
as you will, it reminds me, reading up on what your plans are for that night. You mentioned Club Soda a moment ago. Just all these great venues throughout our city mm-hmm. and around the country that are no longer. And you pay tribute to those in this book, don't you?
Yeah, quite a few of them. I mean, you know, Vancouver, as I mentioned, is an ever-shifting landscape, real estate landscape. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why a lot of the clubs don't exist anymore in Vancouver is because we're in the almost like an island, like you know, kind of like a Manhattan or a Sydney, Australia, where the real estate is so incredibly valuable that the only place to go is up in the air.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these clubs were, you know, one-story clubs or two-story clubs that were in the way of 30-story condo buildings. So when the condo boom hit Vancouver, a lot of these clubs, like Richards on Richards and like the Starfish Room, they just disappeared. And now others just kind of ran their course and closed down. You know, one of the most legendary clubs in Vancouver, the Town Pump, down on 66 Water Street in Gastown, it's still there, and it has heritage status. And that building, you know, all of Gastown, mm-hmm. you can't build up Gastown. And it's sitting there, and it's empty. And so, you know, we need someone to come along and save the Town Pump. The railway was kind of reborn mm-hmm. as a new place, so it's still there. So there's some good news. But, yeah, a lot of the venues are gone. And the Commodore was one of the, you know, Aaron Chapman, fellow author, and, you know, literally wrote the book on the Commodore.
Yeah.
He was the one who said to me, we were planning to play a much, much smaller venue for this, and he was the one who said, oh, Grant, come on, you've got to do the Commodore. And I said, are you crazy? That place is huge. Like, you know, as I mentioned, we're a 300-person, that's where we're comfortable.
Yeah.
He said, no, you got to do it. It's the only venue left standing. The railway was shuttered at that time.
Yeah.
It's the only venue left standing from the smuggler's era. When you play this town, 80s, 90s, 2000s, you got to play the Commodore. You got to play the Commodore. So I thought he was crazy, but we're doing it. It's doing well. We've sold lots of tickets. You know, I'm doing a book launch portion in the early evening. We're going to do a poster exhibit of, because I kept everything,
yeah.
as the book is details.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a big poster exhibit in the lobby of the Commodore. We've got lots of friends, bands coming into town, Calgary, Los Angeles. And we're doing a big slideshow all night long within the Commodore of posters and photos and memorabilia and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be, no bones about it, a nostalgia trip for sure.
Yeah.
And it's the only Vancouver show the Smugglers are going to play, so it's a one night only situation.
The other thing about this book, because it's from all the stuff you saved, you mentioned that just a sec ago, the diaries especially. Do you still keep a diary today?
You know, it's funny. I don't. I do so much writing. You know, I write a column every week. I do a lot of blog writing for the CBC. I write my own blog occasionally on my own site. That the diary and the journal keeping has definitely fallen to the wayside, because what everyone has been saying about this book, Dirty Windshield, is, oh, it's so incredible you kept these diaries.
Yeah.
But, and I think to myself, gee, I don't keep any right now. But my column is kind of like my diary. I've written a lot about my kids in my column. You know, I write about what is going on in my life in my column.
Yeah.
So that kind of charts. That's sort of a replacement in a way. So I'm still writing a lot about my life. It's just in different mediums.
Yeah, and we have Twitter and Facebook updates. So
exactly. And that none of that existed. There was no social media. Not only was there no social media, there was no internet.
Yeah.
And so it was very much a different landscape. I mean, you know, as we detail in the book, like if me and Nardwar wanted to book a band, we would have to track them down, like in their motel in the middle of nowhere, you know, in Thunder Bay, and just like call motel after motel after motel. And if we struck the right one, we'd say, hey, Gruesomes, you want to play a show in Vancouver? And they'd say, how the hell did you find us? But that's what we'd have to do, because there was no email and there was no Facebook Messenger and all that kind of stuff. It was just, we had to just use our resources, which was the phone, period.
Yeah. The other thing I'm in reading the book, and I just found delightful, because we're in this year where our country is celebrating its 150th birthday.
Yeah.
You've traveled across this country.
Yeah.
Back and forth and over and out and all kinds of places. What do you think you've learned over the years, especially in the smuggler's years, about Canada?
Well, it's a really nice question. You know, I'm with both of my travels with the smugglers and with working at the CBC, I'm very proud to say that I've been to all 10 provinces and all 3 territories,
mm-hmm.
some of them over and over. But I was just able to add Nunavut to the puzzle a couple years ago, which was the final piece, and it was great. But I think what I've learned is that there is community everywhere, and there's a very welcoming Canadian community everywhere. And so wherever I have traveled in Canada, and I hope this is the same for everybody, I have felt very welcomed wherever I've gone. It's a little bit, I will admit that I get a little bit more of a, there's more context, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm either working for the CBC or I'm, you know, with this band. So we're welcomed into the town. But, whether it's St. John's, Newfoundland, or Iqaluit, or Dawson City, or Nelson, British Columbia, wherever, there's just these amazing communities. And one of the greatest things about being in a band is that you often, say you're a tourist and you go to these places, you might miss the cool street.
Mm.
You come to Vancouver, if you land on Hastings instead of Water Street, you could be like, oh my God, this is a scary town.
Mm-hmm.
But the smugglers didn't have that problem, because we were often, even though some of our venues were in sketchy areas, we often would have literally directions to a cultural hub or to a community center, you know, a record store or a club or whatever, where people like us would gather, and so we would meet the communities across Canada. And sometimes it took a while, because there were plenty of times in the early days where we'd show up and there wouldn't be a single person there.
Uh-huh.
So, but we would do it, you know, one by one by one, one fan at a time, one fan at a time. Same with this Commodore show, you know, selling one ticket at a time over months and months. And that's just the way we do it, and it's so that's my answer would be community, just finding all these wonderful communities right across the country, and finding so many of them being welcoming.
So as I told you before we started, how much I enjoyed the book, and you know how much I enjoy the West Ender column, and
Yeah,
and your work on the CBC. I mean, you're on Quinn's show regularly and all the other shows on, that we listen to here in Vancouver. Is there another book? I mean, it's as cruel a question as this book's just come out. But I mean, as a fan, I'm wondering, is there something else?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think in threes, so I do kind of think like, okay, there, I've done my trifecta, you know, I've done my trilogy of memoir writing. And that's a, you know, those three books, you put them together and you've got a pretty big chunk of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I, so basically now that I've written three memoirs, I'm very much interested in, you know, writing about someone else. I mean, a lot of my column, I write about other Vancouverites doing great things or celebrating anniversaries or, you know, I write a lot about small business in Vancouver and people that have persevered. You know, I had a fun time writing about Nat's New York Pizzeria over in Kitts in the West End, which,
Yeah.
25 years.
Yeah.
You know, they survived the pizza wars and everything else, and they just make, you know, on pizza level, pretty healthy, thin crust pizza. And then this week I had a lot of fun writing about Rob Joyce, this real, real character real estate agent in the West End who just, like, cracks me up. But, so that's what I like doing. I like writing about other people. And, I just like telling stories. And in my books, yes, they're memoirs about me, but I tell a hell of a lot of other people's stories in those books as well, the people that surround me, and I get to color in their lives. And so I want to write, for my next book, I think I want to write about a legendary local musician who's been around a long, long time, and he doesn't have a book, and I want to write his story. I can't tell you who it is, but you might be able to guess. It's not Del Richards. He's gone now.
Yeah.
But it's not Red Robinson. He's not a musician, but you know what I mean. He has his book out. But it's another guy who's real, real incredible story. I interviewed him last year for the CBC, which is when I got the idea. I'm like, this story is incredible. And I am trying hard to convince him, but he said no already. So I'm going to try. I'm just going to keep bugging him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if there's a lesson here in your life, I mean, if you persevere, you'll end up doing it, and it'll turn out wonderful, as this book has.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure talking to you again. I'm a fan, and this book is such a delight. I hope it does well for you, because a lot of people ought to read it.
Well, I really, really appreciate it, and I really, you know, what means a lot to me is that you're coming at it from someone who isn't particularly or at all a fan of rock and roll, but you can still take enjoyment out of it. So that's what I hope for readers everywhere.
Thanks for this, Grant.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
This Saturday at the Commodore, see Grant and the Smugglers and a lot of other guests, too. Festivities start at 7 p.m., and tickets are available through Ticketmaster. This new book is called Dirty Windshields, The Best and the Worst of the Smugglers, Tour Diaries. Douglas and McIntyre is its publisher. Grant Lawrence, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.